Hello, welcome to Hindsight here on RN Summer. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, a story told through the eyes of two people separated by 150 years. One a scientist and naturalist, the other an artist with a passion for the natural world. The English naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace is considered one of the true unsung scientists of the 19th century. He was a confidant of Charles Darwin and even a pallbearer at Darwin's funeral. Alfred Wallace is known by many as Darwin's secret sharer, the man who failed to get an equal amount of the credit, but that's probably not how Wallace himself would have put it. Contemporary Australian artist John Wolseley and our producer Ros Bluett decided to trace Wallace's journey, driven by a curiosity to track the experience of this young naturalist.
I was actually able to hold in my hand a Dromiceops, which is a tiny little mousy marsupial thing, and I was able to look at its tummy and see that it had a pouch like a kangaroo. Not many people have the fortune to actually hold in their hands an example which shows how this actually happened. That's when you really understand what evolution is.
In 1854, a curious English naturalist, 31-year-old Alfred Russel Wallace, set sail from Singapore in a southeast direction. Laden with collection boxes, pins, labels and hand lenses, he was on a journey of acquisition to the least known part of the globe. Wallace's meticulous observations of the plant and animal life of these islands led to the naming of the Wallace Line, an invisible boundary separating different flora and fauna. This puzzling discovery of Wallace's sparked theories of natural selection, remarkably similar to those of Charles Darwin. But that's probably where the similarities between the two men ended. Wallace left school at the age of 14, and from then was largely self-taught. Having almost no money, he covered his travel expenses by shipping natural history specimens back to London for sale. As one admirer put it, Alfred Russel Wallace was a man of crotchety independence and lurching enthusiasm. Had he not existed, it would have taken a very peculiar Victorian novelist to create him. Writer Penny Van Oosterzee admits she couldn't dream up such a character, but remains fascinated by his travels and discoveries, and the fact that so little is known about this remarkable 19th century scientist.
He was the man made to understand the planet. He didn't care for social niceties. He read whatever he could. He was a free thinker. He travelled the globe. I mean, he loved the people he was with. He was patient. He was cheerful. He got sick, he tolerated it, he just got over it and he kept going.
The Wallace Line curves its way north from Bali through the Makassar Strait, separating Borneo and Sulawesi. It then winds its way east, south of the Philippines.
It's this line, imaginary line, between Bali and Lombok and Borneo and Sulawesi. Ostensibly on one side you've got Asian flora and fauna, on the other side you've got Australian, and the line is so sharp.
...150 years after Alfred Russel Wallace's journey, contemporary Australian artist John Wolseley became similarly captivated with the stark difference in the flora and fauna either side of this invisible line. Just as intriguing to him was the wealth of correspondence between Wallace and Charles Darwin. In 2001, John Wolseley packed up his paint box, paper, books and a good coffee percolator and decided to trace the young naturalist's journey, to get a glimpse of the world through Wallace's eyes.
Both Darwin and Wallace looked at things on the ground, beetles, even worms, and then extrapolated these huge theories about how the dynamics of the world works. The idea that hit me was to visit a vast area of the earth in the company of one of those great scientists.
Over a period of 4 years, John Wolseley moved back and forth between the various islands, documenting his discoveries and impressions. Creating with colour and imagination the strange, new and wonderful world that had revealed itself to Alfred Wallace.
And if I went to the Malay archipelago, sort of with Russell in my pocket, that would be such a wonderful way of doing the same thing myself, but with a companion. The companion being Wallace and myself being a paintbrush.
Situated upon the equator and bathed by the tepid water of the great tropical oceans, this region enjoys a climate more uniformly hot and moist than almost any other part of the globe, and teems with natural productions that are elsewhere unknown. The richest of fruits and the most precious of spices are here indigenous. It produces the giant flowers of the Rafflesia, the great green-winged Ornithoptera, the man-like orangutan, and the gorgeous bird of paradise. To the ordinary Englishman, this is perhaps the least known part of the globe. Scarcely any of our travellers go to explore it, and in many collections of maps it is almost ignored, being divided between Asia and the Pacific Islands. The traveller, however, soon acquires different ideas. He sails for days or even weeks.
So I thought to myself, if I go to the Malay archipelago with Wallace, I could recreate what he did by myself looking at the plants, leaves, birds, and understand it so much more through his eyes.
He finds that voyages among these islands are commonly reckoned by weeks and months. He soon comes to look at this region as one apart from the rest of the world, with its own races of men and own aspects of nature, with a climate, vegetation, and animal life altogether peculiar to itself.
Wallace wasn't even going to go across from Java to Bali at all, and then to Lombok, which is where the Wallace Line is, the southern section of it. He was actually going to try and catch a boat from Singapore, where he was, to Malacca, which is the current Ujung Pandang. A boat wasn't going. He spent many weeks trying to wait for one, and he finally caught a boat to Bali. And then from Bali he made his way across this narrow strait, but with ripping current straight through to Lombok. And Wallace got there on a prow, you know, with local people, cramped in a little space, drinking his Madeira and his gin.
I went on this marvellous original prow. It was almost like going there with some amazing guide. Almost felt I was Alfred Wallace.
And then he landed on Lombok, and immediately he was confronted with this loud, raucous noise of Australian birds. He turned around and he looked across the strait and he saw Bali just across the water, but he turned around and looked at Lombok and it seemed Australian, and he thought, well, hell, I didn't collect the birds from Bali, and here on Lombok they're different, they're Australian. And he just couldn't fathom what had gone on, and that started him going. So right at the very beginning of his trip, he suddenly confronted with something that was totally unexpected and inexplicable.
Of the boundary between the Oriental and the Australian region, its southeast limits I draw between the islands of Bali and Lombok. Barbets, the black grasshopper thrush, the yellow-headed weaver, and the Malay oriole reach Bali, but not Lombok. On crossing over to Lombok, I found a totally different set of species, most of which were utterly unknown, not only on Java, but also in Borneo, Sumatra, and Malacca. On Lombok were white cockatoo, honeysuckers, parrots and friarbirds, belonging to family groups which are entirely absent to the west.
And Wallace thought it was marvellous, and he got to the island, and the locals took him to see Port Bird of Paradise. And it was that trip that kept him in the Malay Archipelago. There was something that was so stunningly beautiful, and he had found it, and there was not a single other white person anywhere near him. And in fact, all the locals thought that he was the main specimen and just would gather around him in their hundreds just to stare at this crazy man who would sit in a little room with his box of noisome specimens wafting away and and his little teacups. And I mean, he was like something out of Alice in Wonderland. And of course, that book became one of his favourites in his old age.
Much to my surprise, a tremendous, loud, hoarse screaming was heard, and the bird was brought to me. This was the most curious object, as large as a pigeon, but without a particle of plumage on any part of it. It was exceedingly plump and soft, with a semi-transparent skin, so that it looked more like a bag of jelly with head and feet stuck on than a real bird. The extraordinary habit of the male in plastering up the female with her egg and feeding her during the whole time of incubation is common to several of the large hornbills and is one of those strange facts in natural history which are stranger than fiction.
Both men enjoyed the quirky and absurd. Wallace would set up his china tea set and arrange delicacies in the cramped space of his small thatched hut. His equipment included guns, pins and pliers, specimen boxes and butterfly nets. His was the quintessential 19th century battle between man and nature. Wolseley entered that same world, staying in thatched huts that had changed little in over 100 years. His canvas, sketch pads, brushes and jars replaced Wallace's dissecting tools, and a coffee percolator stood in place of the tea set. But books, both fact and fiction, were indispensable to both of them.
In his wonderful book, Island Life, Alfred Russel Wallace, lo and behold, what do I read? It says, even more remarkable are the peculiarities of shape and colour in a number of Celebesian butterflies. The Celebes was what's now called Sulawesi. And he says, these are found to vary all in the same manner, indicating some general cause of variation able to act upon totally distinct groups and produce them all to a common result. You can imagine what fun it is to look at a butterfly and then think there's something odd about that butterfly, and then a bit later on discover that he found that. But my whole trip was always those sort of things, something magic about actually rediscovering it all yourself. I hope that sense of awe comes out in the drawings.
Wolseley works in watercolour, which allows spontaneity and uncertainty to drift across the paper. The blurred edges of islands, which are shaped as leaves, merge into the imagined divide of the Wallace line, which is often depicted in Morse code-like staccato. Intricately detailed butterfly wings, all slightly different, hover either side.
I then draw a butterfly, which is exactly what dear old Wallace was doing. He'd be looking at the shape of something, and then he'd be saying, well, why has this butterfly got these funny calipers in just one part? And then what will happen if I go to another island and will the wings have another structure? And then what happens is, with him and to a lesser extent with me, is you start to build a picture up of the whole contraption, if you see what I mean. The most exciting thing in the world is to have this sense that you're getting some kind of an idea of the meta pattern, the giant abstract movements of the earth.
From many points of view, these islands form one compact geographical whole, and as such, they have always been treated by travellers and men of science. But a more careful and detailed study of them reveals the unexpected fact that they are divisible into two portions nearly equal in extent, which widely differ in their natural products, and really form parts of two of the primary divisions of the Earth.
The fact that you've got this string of islands, Indonesia, connecting Asia with Australia, so the juxtaposition of islands, the fact that it's on the edge of three continental plates, that you've had ice ages there, has made evolution rev up to such an extent, it's hard to explain why two nearby islands will have totally different flora and fauna. And it's simply a matter of working out, how did the species get there? Was it with currents? Was it with the ice age, where they could have traversed a narrower stretch of water? The whole idea of evolution on islands and how things got to islands.
But even, I found, with things like the warblers, the old world warblers and the new world warblers, they've evolved the same kinds of songs.
Wallace, he couldn't believe it and he couldn't explain it. He was standing there totally perplexed and just started collecting birds and beetles and moths and butterflies, because everything he saw was new. I mean, the man collected something like 83,000 beetles, you know, 13,000 moths and 8,000 birds, 7,000 shells, and he just kept collecting. And unlike any other person, I suppose, of his time, theorising was, well, let's go back a bit. Theorising at his time was done in London or in Berlin or in Paris. It wasn't actually done in the field. You didn't actually theorise about life on Earth anywhere except in the salons of these places. But here he was, a flycatcher, as somebody called him in an impolite way, actually looking at what was going on and noticing variations in everything he caught. One beetle was slightly different to another, one mammal different to another, one bird different to another, and they were not in the places that they were meant to be.
I love the thought that things can start with very simple pieces of observation. I wrote, on a particular day, in a particular place, I hold a leaf in my hand. I make a drawing of it, and around the image of it, I draw the landscape where it grew. Whilst drawing it, I wonder, why this kind of leaf on this kind of terrain? In the same place, I draw a feather, a moth's wing, and then a bird.
In this short sketch of the most striking peculiarities of the Celebes, I have been obliged to enter much into details. But unless I have done so, my exposition would have lost much of its force and value. Although hemmed in every side by islands teeming with varied forms of life, its productions have a surprising amount of individuality. And I must conclude that such anomalies and eccentricities point to an origin in a remote antiquity. Celebes must be one of the oldest parts of the archipelago.
I wrote about how it may be possible to look at a leaf in a particular part of an island and then move to another island and then look at another leaf and then to have theories about why this one was like that and that one was like the other. That's exactly, of course, what old Wallace was doing, and it was sort of eerie sometimes. Like, for instance, there's a most wonderful passage here about butterflies.
Wallace communicated regularly with Charles Darwin, so he was aware of all the ideas going on at the time, the Malthusian ideas, Lyell's ideas about geology. There were a whole bunch of new things that were emerging at the time to give him some sort of framework in which to think, something that wasn't based on the Bible. Because he was a free thinker, he pulled ideas from everywhere to try and explain what was going on. But it was the Malthus paper that made him realise that natural selection was something that was causing evolution. But before that, he had noticed that the variations between different types of animals always happened in the same location. Like if you had a species that was very closely related to another one, they were close together. And he realised that change happened in time depending on what happened to the land.
M- Most naturalists now admit that these facts can only be explained by the greater or less lapse of time since the islands were upraised from beneath the ocean or were separated from the nearest land. And this will be generally indicated by the depth of the intervening sea. The depth of the sea will generally be a measure of time, and in like manner, the change which organic forms have undergone is a measure of time. When we make proper allowance for the continued introduction of new animals and plants from surrounding countries by those natural means of dispersal, which have been so well explained by Sir Charles Lyell and Mr. Darwin, it is remarkable how close these two measures correspond.
Wallace realized that when he went to the islands of Maluku, there were not so many species on each island, but each species was completely different. And he understood that those species had come from either Australia or from mainland Asia and then evolved on the island. And it was that archipelago of magical islands that finally made him see that evolution must happen. The animals got there in a sort of a sweepstakes notion, by accident, landed on the island, and then evolved to change. And his Sarawak law was that any new species is always going to be close to its parent species in space and also in time. And that was actually the foundation, I suppose, of evolution, that a species evolved in the same location as its ancestor. But then as time went on, this second letter, the letter that shook Darwin to the core, came out and said, not only that, but they evolve close to their ancestors, but then they change gradually in time and in space and move, and they change infinitely, and they keep changing, and that's how evolution occurs, through natural selection.
The prevailing orthodoxy in Western culture was that nothing was a matter of chance. God shaped and put all species in place through special acts of creation. Species were essentially fixed and incapable of varying. Yet if some islands were never connected to the mainland, it implied that their populations were in some way accidental. Alfred Wallace supported Charles Darwin's theory that some oceanic islands had likely never been connected. This, insisted Wallace, best explained the vastly differing origin of much of the flora and fauna of the Malay archipelago.
And here are two very, very big leaves. One leaf from Java and one leaf from Malaysia. The branching is completely different. The structure of the leaf is got a completely different structure. It was evolution trying to find how to make a leaf. So there you are, deep in the jungle, sharing with evolution how it made it an actual leaf. And do you see here, I've got the leaf there, and then I drew another leaf from Malaysia, and I'm tracing all the little, tiny little patterns on it. It seems to me that direct experience is one of the reasons why we love reading about someone like Wallace. I mean, imagine being able to work out the whole dynamic of the giant movements of the earth from the direct experience of holding butterflies in your hand.
So Wallace wrote to Darwin at the very early time when he went to Indonesia as the only other person who was going to understand what was going on in his head. So Darwin at all times was aware of what Wallace was doing, but in the early days he didn't pay much attention. Even when the Sarawak law came out, he looked at it and thought, oh, he's onto it. But then, you know, life went on and he didn't think about it. But Charles Lyell, the geologist, and Huxley went to Darwin and said, look, mate, you know, Wallace is onto something here, so you've got to stop fiddling around with your big idea and actually put it together and publish it. And then on the eve of that, he got a letter from Wallace, which had on a thin sheet of rice paper, had the words that described perfectly evolution.
At the time in question, I was suffering from a sharp attack of intermittent fever. And every day during the cold and succeeding hot fits, I had to lie down for several hours, during which time I had nothing to do but to think over subjects then particularly interesting me. It occurred to me to ask the question, why do some die and some live? And the answer was clearly that on the whole, the best fitted live. Then it suddenly flashed upon me that this self-acting process would necessarily improve the race, because in every generation the inferior would inevitably be killed off and superior would remain. That is, the fittest would survive.
You can just imagine Darwin standing there with this thin paper that had come across the world with the theory of evolution that he had been working on for 20 years, that he'd known about all this time but was too terrified to actually get out there with it because of all the things that it represented.
The more I thought over it, the more I became convinced that I had at length found the long-sought-for law of nature that solved the problem of the origin of species. The two succeeding evenings, I wrote it out carefully in order to send it to Darwin by the next post, which would leave in a day or two. I wrote a letter to him, in which I said that I hoped the idea would be as new to him as it was to me, and that it would supply the missing factor to explain the origin of species.
And there he was. He must have shaken. He must have shaken with that sheet of paper in his hand and looked at the little scribbly writing, because Wallace did it in a fever. I mean, he came out of a malarial fever, saw it immediately, wrote it down before he went back into a malarial fever, and then sent it off. So there was Darwin standing there with his sheet of paper, thinking, it's my idea, and now someone else has come up with it.
I asked him if he thought it sufficiently important to show it to Sir Charles Lyell, who had thought so highly of my former paper.
And then it was Lyell and Huxley that said, OK, let's publish the theory together. So it was Darwin and Wallace's theory of evolution.
Alfred Russel Wallace was knee-deep in the New Guinea wet season when his paper, along with notes from Charles Darwin, was presented at the Linnaean Society in London. Prominent scientists at the time were astonished and embarrassed at the apparent simplicity of the solution, while church people were outraged. Wallace seemed to care little about the excitement that was taking place in London, or who got credit for what. He had been acknowledged by the great Charles Darwin and welcomed into the select fraternity of naturalists whose interests took them beyond the mere description of species. He continued what he loved doing and where he felt most comfortable.
I looked at the tree with my binoculars and they reveal a black-naped oriole on the rim of this dark mass. Preens and shakes the black stripes across its head and tail and shivers its yellow wings. So that's the little drawing. This is a sketchbook, so I've written little notes on this. It's a catching sun, top of canopy, another sun just risen. Oriole grooming, black wing, seen through the foliage like a bit of twig.
Wolseley's studies of birds, trees, lichens and leaves explore detail further, but in their detail become more abstract. The islands are as if seen from above, from the eye of a bird, rather than a cartographer. Deep-sea trenches of turquoise and indigo edge into lighter tones, becoming more obviously separate from the browns, oranges and pinks of the surrounding landmasses.
Well, I'm always playing. Well, what will this do and what will that do? To go back to Darwin and Wallace, evolution could be described as a kind of different things playing with each other all the time, like in this kind of mad game. In a sense, making a work of art very often is engaging in the same kind of play, allowing water to hit the pigment, different things that paint will do. What actually happens if I then put a whole mass of charcoal beside it? So there might be an argument to say that the way to make a painting has a similarities to the way evolution works. This may be extremely far-fetched, but I think I could get away with it.
Wallace also attempted to get away with some odd ideas, but many of his were simply prescient. Shortly before his astounding letter to Darwin, he'd formulated what he called a law of species origin. But Wallace was told by a colleague to quit theorising and stick to gathering facts. Luckily, he ignored the condescending advice and continued making observations, gathering specimens, taking notes, and drawing sketches. His achievements were certainly a triumph of persistence, and he glowed in the aftermath.
Wallace was chuffed. I mean, there he was, you know, he knew he wasn't well regarded. He was just this insect collector, this fly collector, which would just catch things and send them back to the museums and parlours of Europe. He wasn't a gentleman, and here was a gentleman who was actually paying attention to him. So he was very pleased. He was thrilled that he would have his name on the same publication as Darwin. And the reality is that Darwin had come up with it straight after the Galapagos and had been working on it for 2 decades. But perhaps he got bogged down. He had also a lot of strife in his personal life with his daughter dying. But also he was scared, I think, of coming out with this theory because, in fact, it did mean the death of God in many ways.
I have no difficulty in conceiving an ascending scale of being, rising up into what the Christian means by God. But the idea of a supreme being does not, of course, explain the mystery of the universe. The child's questions as to when God began and where he came from still remain unanswered. The fundamental problem is, why does anything exist at all? But naturalists are now beginning to look beyond this and to see that there must be some other principle regulating the infinitely varied forms of animal life.
His spiritual descriptions don't mention God. They don't mention even a first cause. In fact, he goes out to say, I don't want to talk about a first cause that created the world, or the kind of phraseology that, let's say, the intelligent design people might use. Not at all. He talks about a great force underneath the world, and Wallace thought that there was some kind of underlying pattern.
Alfred Russel Wallace arrived back in London in 1862, having travelled 14,000 miles within the archipelago and acquiring over 125,000 specimens. In his old age, Wallace recognised that his 8 years of wandering the Malaysian and Indonesian islands constituted the central and controlling incident of his life. A prolific note-taker, but always distracted, Wallace then took 7 years to complete the task of documenting his travels. His Malay Archipelago is now regarded as one of the greatest natural history books of the 19th century.
There's a fantastic paragraph where Wallace sees this butterfly, and he says it caused him palpitations as much as any palpitations that you get when you're near to death, because it was so beautiful, all the things that you might imagine tropical paradise to be.
Wallace was at home amid the teeming life of his Southeast Asian wonderland. Today, he is recognised as a towering figure in the transition from old-fashioned natural history to modern biology, the co-discoverer of the theory of evolution by natural selection. Wallace had the same idea that made Charles Darwin famous. The tale of Darwin and Wallace, and how one became synonymous with evolution, while the other a footnote, is one of the great ironies in the history of science. Yet Wallace never begrudged his fate. He remained extraordinarily free from concern about who got credit for what. His stock in trade was ideas, and he was forever captivated and enthralled by what the world around him revealed.
I have now concluded my task. I have given in more or less detail a sketch of my 8 years' wanderings among the largest and the most luxuriant islands which adorn our Earth's surface. I have endeavoured to convey my impressions...
If Wallace... just assume that Wallace would end up in Indonesia today and we hadn't come up with a theory of evolution and there hadn't been a Darwin, you would not have been able to come up with a theory of evolution. Much of the world has been so decimated that you couldn't have seen the magic of life today. You wouldn't have been able to do it. You just don't have that great diversity. The rainforests are nearly all gone in Maluku where he went. I think Wallace would have wept if he'd gone there today.
People like Wallace and Darwin are originators. They set up a big idea. Let's say in Wallace's case, the big idea was on either side of the Wallace line, evolution had happened in different ways. Because of those marvelous people, an artist now can recreate what they've actually experienced. In fact, I think it was John Cocteau who said that artists are those who make science visible.
So he was made for it. Wallace was the man made to understand the planet. I think if there was one person I would like to meet, it would actually be him. If I could go back and find someone to, if you had to spend time with somebody from the past, I would like to go and spend time with Alfred Russel Wallace.
In Tracing Wallace, you heard writer and ecologist Penny Van Oosterzee and artist John Wolseley. Excerpts from Alfred Russel Wallace's memoirs, The Malay Archipelago, were read by Drayton Morley. The sound engineer was Russell Stapleton, and Tracing Wallace was produced by me, Ros Blewett.
You know, you Google evolution and you could talk about it for an hour very well. But the sad thing is that so much of this information now is purely cerebral and mediated through the damned radio and the damned television.
A portrait of Alfred Russel Wallace now hangs, along with an older one of Charles Darwin, in the meeting room of the Linnaean Society in London, the very same society to which the Darwin-Wallace scientific co-discovery was announced in July 1858. And artist John Wolseley's famous painting, The Territories of Birds Remembering Gondwana and Laurasia, now hangs in the foyer of a major investment bank in London. For more information about today's program or further reading, and for a glimpse of John Wolseley's beautiful watercolours of his journey through the Malay Archipelago, just go to our website, abc.net.au/radionational, and look for Hindsight in the drop-down box. This is RN Summer. I'm Lorena Allam.